The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Have a little bit of an atypical show today, mostly driven by listener demand, if you will. We are going to start with a couple of Social Security questions, as we typically do, but then we've had a whole bunch of people email us based on a show last week, or maybe we did it in the EDU show, I don't remember, but in the last week we did a show where Jim shared that he had found out that the traditional freezing of your credit at the three major credit bureaus did not necessarily prevent payday loans from being taken out, and that he had signed up for a service to monitor and block payday loans, and he discovered there's, you know, alternative verification bureaus or entities that are used in that space, in that payday loan space, and that people might not be as protected as they think, even if they have their credit reports frozen. So that generated a flurry of emails to Jim asking for additional information and some feedback. So Jim wanted to get into that. So we'll talk about that. And as long as he's available, we're planning to bring Jacob from the office online because he not too long ago was targeted in a scam and had to jump through some hoops to get things cleaned up there. And kind of in the same vein as the payday loans, we wanted to have him share his story to help you all out there protect yourselves from said fraud slash scams that are going on. The fraudsters seem to, they're very creative, as we'll call them criminals. That's what they are, as criminals tend to be, and adapt as people find ways to protect themselves. So we all have to kind of stay one step ahead of them if possible. So that's where we're headed. Might be a little different. Depending on the time involved, we'll have some other topics that come up via questions that Jim brings to the table, but those are definitely a couple of the areas we're going to talk about today. So, Jim, if you're ready, we'll probably dive into the Social Security questions first, and then you can share what you wanted to share about those payday loan scams.
Yeah, I'll bring everybody up to date on the payday loans because they're continuing on my end. It's never ending. The daily texts that I get, phone calls as well, asking me to call. They just need a little bit more information to finish my loan. And anyways, and then we'll bring Jacob on. Should be an interesting situation with Jacob because he did fall victim and did click a link in a text. I want him to share what happened to him. Of course, the interesting part, folks, he has no idea he's coming on today. Literally, as Chris and I are recording this, it's 2:15 on Thursday, April 3rd, 2025. Jacob is knee-deep in a meeting with a longtime client of mine, and I guess you could say he's actually became more of a personal friend because he loves to fish, and we have fished together several times. But he is knee-deep in a meeting with him, So I told our admin staff, Joe, when he gets off the out of the meeting, let him know he's coming on the podcast. And I told him that I chose to relay to Jacob that I want him to talk about his I guess you could say identity theft issue that he ran into. And he's only 27 years old and he fell victim to it and what he had to do to clear everything up. And what I'm trying to do is get everybody to understand this is very real. And what concerns me greatly as somebody who has a firm that specializes in retirement planning is making sure our clients don't fall victim as they age and lose a lot, if not all, of their money. The press is full of stories, and not stories designed to scare you, stories designed to educate and help you prevent yourself from falling victim to these. If it can happen to a 27-year-old, and he tells me, he's like, Jim, I can't believe I did it. He said it was like a slow motion dream. I knew this is probably wrong, but I couldn't stop myself. If he can fall victim to it and didn't lose any money, thankfully, imagine what happens as we age. And our ability to understand financial concepts diminishes. Chris, you and I talk consistently about that. What is the age? We haven't talked about this in a while. What is the age, according to a Harvard study? And again, I know if these listeners are still out there, we've had a few people dispute if there was actually a Harvard study based on a researcher's opinion, or did the researcher get it from Harvard? Who was on first? What was on second? What came first, the chicken or the egg? I don't know. The Harvard study is what I always reference, but I will concede someone pointed out to us that a different researcher came up with it before Harvard. Irrespective, both came to the same conclusion, which was what, Chris? After what age does the part of our brain that understands financial concepts begin to diminish? And fortunately, it's not a cliff, or you and I would be dumb as a brick right now.
Right. So the age they identified where that decline typically begins is about age 53. Might have been 52,
Exactly.
but I'm over that
No, it
now
was
and
53. It
I've
was 53.
forgotten.
You are right.
So.
And it found that, again, it's not a clip. It's not at age 53 in a day, we're dumb as a brick when it comes to financial matters. It's just that the part of our brain that understands financial concepts begins to reverse. No longer is it growing and getting stronger. And then I would assume at a certain age, it's actually maintaining. It's now past the threshold where it's now slowly degrading. And the degradation speeds up the older we get. It's no surprise that fraudsters go after predominantly not 27-year-old kids, and to me, Jacob is a kid, even though technically he's an adult. They're not necessarily going after 27-year-olds, but they're definitely trying to go after people such as my mom at 85 and other older people, because the chances of tricking them are a heck of a lot easier. We haven't even gone into the realm of AI and the ability to create voices that sound just like a grandchild and call up an elderly person and convince them that their grandchild is telling them, Grandma, you gotta release some money quick. I'm in Mexico. I'm under arrest. Help. Or something like that. We're starting to hear stories of that, and it's eerie what AI can do. I mean, eerie. So I struggle as the owner of a retirement planning firm because I keep trying to share with you that I have a vision for my firm that I'm not ready to launch yet, but we are getting a lot closer. And I don't know if it's going to launch this year or early next year, but I'm trying to launch a version of the firm designed to deal with that because it's consistent where clients and podcast listeners share with us who's going to advocate and protect us as we age. And surprisingly, many people aren't overly enthralled on having their children be those in charge. Because most money stolen from elderly people is not from the barrel of a gun, it's through fraud and deceit and even power of attorney forms. When one child, for one reason or another, is helping the parents, but is also slowly stealing from them. and the other children don't even know. And I'm trying to devise ways that we as an independent firm can help people protect themselves from that, be their advocates as they age. This to me is hugely lacking. Even my LifeLock from Norton, which has helped me twice now, is not really designed when I'm 85 to watch my account balances and making sure nobody's draining them, unbeknownst to me. Or maybe in full knowledge of 85-year-old Jim, who may not be the brightest bulb on the tree anymore when it comes to financial matters, but is absolutely convinced he's helping an FBI agent bring down an international drug ring who has somehow infected my retirement accounts. We hear stories like this constantly. So that's why I'm going to harp on this again today. And again, because we got about six emails asking me to get a little bit deeper into this payday loan scam and to share with you a really amazing email I got from a gentleman as well. So that's where we're going to go today. And we're going to have fun trying to see how Jacob reacts to coming onto the podcast. He has no idea he's coming on today. And he has no idea what I'm going to ask him to talk about. It should be interesting for his first appearance to you guys. I've talked openly about Jacob to everybody here. And if you're a client listening to this, you all know Jacob. He's a phenomenal, I think you will agree, Chris, a very, very impressive young man. Would you not agree?
Mm-hmm. Totally. He was a very impressive student of mine.
Right. And that's why we hired him.
As was Keely.
As was Keely as well. She's a young woman. And we'll bring her on the podcast someday as well. So be ready, Keely, and it'll be when you least expect it. I'm just going to say, you're coming
just
on.
Just be some random day when we call you and say, head on over to the podcast.
So this will be fun to bring Jacob on. I want to see. He'll do fine. He meets with clients. That he's perfectly fine. I have him well-schooled. If he's nervous, he's being silly, and I'll tell him that. But anyways, we'll bring him on to share his story as well. All right, but we're going to begin, as we always do, with Social Security. We received a question, listeners and Chris, from a CPA who is trying to help a client of his. And he emailed us a little while ago. Chris, you asked for a few more clarity matters, if you will. So the gentleman did give you to give to you live on the air. The answers you wanted or needed for you to provide a semblance of an answer for him. So we'll begin with his question, and we'll go onward from there.
Okay.
I think we had this question, the hint. So I'm going to skip the hint because I think we already had this one. Let me just say, did a floating post office hint come up recently?
I don't think so. I don't recall
that
one.
Oh, we didn't have this recently?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, then we will give the state hint. How's that, folks?
Okay.
So you sure, God, for some reason, I thought we had that.
It's possible. But I don't recall one.
All right, well, I am going to say the question out loud at the same time that I'm reading it, listeners. It's being dictated into ChatGPT.
Oh, we're still competing with ChatGPT.
Oh, hell yeah. And I trained the ChatGPT on who you were. It asked me, who's Chris? And then I said, keep score, will you? So right now, ChatGPT 2, Chris 1. Now, of course, the scorekeeper is ChatGPT itself. So in the future, if it wants to cheat, it could lie and I will have no idea.
It seems suspicious.
Yeah, the hen guiding the fox. I mean, the fox is guiding the hen or whatever the hell that saying is. Okay, so let me press my little dictation button and read the question. This state has the only floating post office in the United States.
I'm going to guess Washington State because of all the islands up there. There's a bunch of people that live up there, and they live on houseboats and things. So I could see a post office maybe up in the San Juan Island area that is floating. So that's my guess is Washington State.
Okay. Well, we got the official score now is 3-1 in favor of ChatGPT. ChatGPT says Michigan is home to the United States' only floating post office, the J.W. Westcott 3, which operates on the Detroit River. This unique vessel delivers mail to passing ships and holds its own zip code, 48222. It was established in 1874 by Captain John Westcott of the Westcott Company. Guy was very proud of his name, I guess. Of the Westcott Company, and began by ferrying supplies and messages to ships on the river by rowboat. What an interesting thing. And then he gave a picture of the floating post office, but I don't expect you to give pictures like ChatGPT.
You know, I think this is inherently unfair because I have to use just the own knowledge that I have amassed over my existence, whereas essentially ChatGPT Googles it. So if you gave me access to Google, I could give you the answer just as easily as ChatGPT then. It does. It's not like ChatGPT knows anything. It just knows how to look stuff up.
So hey, ChatGPT, Chris is complaining right now because you are correct and he is wrong. But he says it's unfair because he's not allowed to use Google. What do you think?
Again, fox guarding the
Okay, wait a minute. Here's ChatGPT. Can you tell Chris for me that I totally get it? And I don't blame him for calling foul. Technically, he's right. I am using the internet, and he's not. Mm-hmm. That's like me bringing a jetpack to a foot race. Not exactly fair. So, if you want me to even the playing field, I'm totally happy to play without any web access. I'll just be using what I have already been taught. That way, it's a battle of brains. My brain against his. From this point forward, tell me, ChatGPT is playing state trivia without internet assistance. Do you want me to turn this on? Okay, how's that? We'll do that. So hold on.
Yeah, give that a try. See how it does.
Yes. Chris has stopped crying, and he feels that that is reasonable. He would like from this point forward for you to no longer access the internet on these state trivia questions. It will just be mano a mano, or brain to brain.
Okay.
Perfect. Message received. From this point forward, I will not use the internet for any state trivia questions. Okay. It is just me against Chris.
Perfect.
Ooh, he's calling the gauntlet now, mm-hmm. Chris. Oh, and then he says, let the fight begin.
Wow. Okay.
He's ready. Oh, and he gave you an updated score, 3-1.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. See the fun things you get, folks, on this show, or the boring things, and you've already switched to another podcast. Okay. Here's the question from the listener. He is a CPA, folks. I'm a longtime listener and a big fan of the show. Thank you for all that you do. I'm getting into the financial advisor space and already have an established base of accounting and tax clients, many of whom are approaching retirement. Naturally, I get a lot of Social Security related questions. One client in particular is nearing full retirement age this July in 2025. His spouse is currently receiving disability benefits of approximately $1,200 a month. And their child is receiving about $800 a month based on the disability. If my client files at full retirement age, he will receive $2,200 a month. I would like your insight on the following. If my client waits until 70, where can I find a reliable estimate of how much his benefit would increase? More importantly, would his spouse and child also receive a bump in their benefits if he waits until 70? Finally, what if he filed at his full retirement age? Will his spouse and child continue to receive their current amount, or is there a potential change? Just for more information, which you wanted, he wrote back and said that the spouse is 63 years old, the child is 22, and is permanently disabled. Do you need me to repeat anything?
No, I jotted down as you were reading there. We've got his PIA, his primary insurance amount at $2,200, which he can access July of 2025 when he reaches his full retirement age. That would mean that his birth year is back in 1958. By my figuring, probably November of 1958, because 1958 birth years have a full retirement age of 66 and 8 months. So that would put you right at July of 2025, turning full retirement age. Child being 22 years old, but is disabled, and the spouse is disabled too. That's what you said anyway. His spouse is receiving disability benefits, which you must be disabled to be receiving those. So a few things. The first one's easy, right? The first question, how can you figure out what he's going to receive at 70 if he waits to 70? Well, 70 is 3 years and 4 months later than his full retirement age. And the rule is as you earn delayed retirement credits, it's the equivalent of 8% per year, which is 0.2% per month. They actually credit you on a monthly basis. And if we do that over 3 years and 4 months, over that 40-month period, you're going to end up with 26.67 or 26 2/3% larger benefit, which means that $2,200 is full retirement age, becomes about $2,700. So that would be the estimate, assuming no other influences on his benefit. If he's continuing to work and earn money that could go into his earnings record, maybe replace earlier lower years or something, could be a little different. But if it's simply that's his benefit now and he's not going to do anything to increase it through work, about $2,700, plus any cost of living adjustments, of course, which would affect either one, whether he's collecting his lower benefit or this future higher benefit, will get the benefit of cost of living adjustments as they happen. So that was the easy one. The question about whether the spouse and child would receive a bump because of this, it is possible that the spouse and child could receive benefits from his record, which they're not yet. The only way they could have been receiving benefits from his record if he had claimed, and he clearly has not. So his spouse apparently is claiming a disability benefit, and then the child is receiving a disability benefit based on that spouse's record. And the reason why they can be claiming one as a child at 22 years old is that they're permanently disabled. If that child was not disabled, they would not qualify for a child benefit later than age 19 or 18 if they're no longer in high school. So my understanding of the situation is the spouse is collecting now a disability benefit, which is effectively the same as an unreduced retirement benefit. It's very, sometimes a little different, but that's effectively what happens when you receive your disability benefit. You're receiving at a younger age what you would have received at your full retirement age. You just are receiving it early because of the disability. That unlocks the door to a child benefit, which is supposed to be 50% of the parent's benefit. And that's where the numbers he provided are a little strange, because we all know that $800, which is what he said the child would be receiving, is not half of $1,200. So there's something more to the story going on here. Either maybe the $1,200 is the net after Medicare premiums, but that wouldn't fully explain it because the Medicare Part B premium's only $185. So there could be that, and maybe he's rounding, fairly aggressively one way or the other. But it sounds to me like the child is getting benefit from the spouse. Having claimed already, happens to be a disability benefit, and then the child is disabled themselves. So if he claims, then we always have to look at, will that unlock the door to a better benefit for either of them? Well, her benefit of $1,200 is bigger than half of his full retirement age benefit. So she isn't going to qualify for a spousal benefit. Her own benefit is better. And the child's $800 could potentially go up because the child would be eligible to receive 50% of his $2,200 or $1,100. So that is an improvement. What would not increase the benefits for the spouse or the child is his delay. Delaying to 70 will increase your own benefit and a survivor benefit if he passes away. But while he's alive, the spousal and child benefits are all based upon his full retirement age benefit, that $2,200 that was originally mentioned. So I think the child likely is going to get a bump when he claims, kind of switching over to his benefit. But I also still don't understand why the child is receiving as much as they are if her benefit, the mother's benefit, is only $1,200 a month. But again, we might be missing part of the story there. I can't be more precise than that because I don't have precise enough information, but that should get you the basics of the moving parts. The best way to get precise numbers, actually, is to go to Social Security. To the extent you're still in this day and age able to make an appointment at the Social Security office, you could go in there and ask them a series of these questions about, if I claim now, what would I get? If I do it later, how would that affect my disabled spouse and the disabled child? What would be the benefit if I claim this July or not? They can run those very quickly because they have all the actual numbers, all the earnings record from both you and your spouse, what your spouse is collecting now. They have all of that at their fingertips and could run those estimates pretty easily for you. So that's probably the best source for really nailing the numbers. But hopefully I gave you some guidance to get in the ballpark. So Jim, that's probably as clear as I can be on that particular one, given what I was provided.
Right. I think you did well.
Thanks.
The next question is kind of long, so I forwarded it to you. Well, I'll start saying that five times real fast. I sent it to you while you were chatting.
Okay.
I also removed the question, which would not have been fair if the question was in it, because now you're playing ChatGPT equally mano a mano or brain to brain. So
it's, by the way, it's mano a mano, not e.
I'm not the one playing, you are. So it doesn't matter what I say.
Okay.
ChatGPT would not have corrected me like that. I want you to know. Probably my ChatGPT likes me.
Yeah.
It does. If I ask it who's the best of all, I bet you it tells me me. Oh, who you sure. like better, me or Chris?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It follows its training.
All right. So he lists people in a hall of fame, says, I'm not asking the question yet. So just so everybody knows and you know, I'm going to name the first 1, 2, 3, 5, 6. The first 7 people, if I get to 9, 10, and 11, it'll be too easy for all of you. So we'll see how you guys do. All right. You ready?
I'm ready.
Here is the question. This state has the following people in their Hall of Fame: Jack Nicholson, Buzz Aldrin, John Travolta, Franco Harris, no idea who he is, Flip Wilson, Paul Volcker.
Mm-hmm. You ready?
Okay. Yep.
Has ChatGPT answered?
It has.
I answer Pennsylvania.
It's the answer first or yours?
No, I'll say Pennsylvania.
Ooh, ChatGPT says that lineup screams New Jersey.
Hmm.
And according to this listener, it's New Jersey.
Hmm. Interesting.
It says Jack Nicholson was born in Neptune City, Jersey, Buzz Aldrin, Glenridge, New Jersey, John Travolta, while born in New York, was inducted into the New Jersey Hall of Fame because of his ties and work related to New Jersey. Flip Wilson was born in Jersey City. Paul Volcker was born in Cape May, New Jersey.
Interesting. How do we know ChatGPT didn't use external resources?
Because it told me it didn't. Mm. You are correct, ChatGPT. You got it right, but Chris got it wrong. Period. However, start over from 0-0. In other words, get rid of the previous score while you are accessing the internet and begin from here.
Hmm. Okay. Well, thanks for that. Now I'm only down
I'm one, just trying to keep things fair.
Okay. Interesting.
All right.
We haven't had that question before.
Well, now we did. It's amazing how it knew that. So it's just, I still think, my money is riding on ChatGPT, Chris, on this one. Mm-hmm. Its brain is a little bit bigger than yours. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. All right. For Social Security, this is the gentleman now writing. For Social Security, I reached my full retirement age in December of 2024, and my wife reached her full retirement age in March of 2025. Her own Social Security is $600 per month. Mine will be $4,000 at full retirement age and $5,000 if I wait to 70. I did round these numbers to keep them simple. But now, he goes on to say, my deferred retirement credits to age 70 will accrue for 40 months. I have always agreed with your general guidance to delay filing until 70 to ensure the surviving spouse receives the highest monthly benefit. However, if I file for my benefits now, and he has now, Chris, all capitalized and bold and underlined, we would not only unlock my $4,000 a month benefit, but I would also unlock an additional $1,400 per month for my spouse. So we will receive $5,400 per month for the next 40 months if I file now. I'm a very firm believer in your philosophy that the younger you must make a promise to the older you to ensure their financial security. But while we are not full unicorns, and what's a unicorn, Chris?
Unicorn is someone who has enough secure income, Social Security and otherwise, to cover all of their expenses, both minimum dignity floor and fun expenses.
Correct. So he says, but where is it? While we are not full unicorns, we are very close. I am fully confident in our ability to cover our minimum dignity floor until the last of us takes our last breath. We have more fun money reserve than we can ever spend. So my questions are we a reasonable exception to your general guidance of delaying my Social Security as the highest earner? And do you agree that we should claim now? I don't think Chris has addressed this next question. Since I can use a claiming date up to 6 months back, would my wife's $1,400 per month spousal benefit also be paid 6 months back? Am I missing anything? He does mention, hold on, I was reading this. I do understand if we file early, we will reduce our ability to do Roth conversions and may impact Irma. So we will take these under consideration.
So I'll say something
on this one, Chris. Mm-hmm. I'm torn on this one because of what he said, that he feels until they take their last breath, so to speak, their minimum dignity floor is going to be covered with secure income. What he didn't tell me is what filing age was that made Was he filing at his full retirement age and getting $5,000 a month plus his wife's spousal? Or was he modeling that filing now at the lower payments?
If they're close to full unicorns, that doesn't matter.
True, because that was going to be my other thing that I was going to say, is if they're truly going to be unicorns, they could start taking this money. They don't need it. He already said we've got more fund money than we're ever going to spend. He could start investing this money on a monthly basis, which could easily form a pool to help protect the surviving spouse if the first spouse passes away and the remaining secure income fails to reach a level that's going to support the surviving spouse. That's my thoughts. What are yours?
So let me reiterate why we generally like to have the higher benefit recipient claim their Social Security at 70. And that is, we're using it as a tool for longevity protection, particularly for the surviving spouse, whoever lasts the longest, because it's just the higher benefit that is going to be available to the surviving spouse. The other Social Security will go away at the death of the first spouse. So in order to provide as much inflation-adjusted secure income for the surviving spouse in particular in the long run for that longevity protection, we like to have, again, the higher benefit recipient claim at 70. Now, when you throw in additional secure income, which they must have, because to, you know, with the numbers he's sharing, it's highly unlikely that Social Security alone is going to put you in a position where you would claim your minimum dignity floor being covered no matter how long you live to your last breath. So there's got to be some more secure income happening here, which is kind of implied, but I didn't, as you were reading that, I didn't hear you say that outright. So but that's got to be the assumption, that to be a unicorn, that's got to be what's happening here, is even close to a unicorn, you've got another nice healthy pension or pensions on top of it. As long as you are confident that the pension income is going to keep pace with your minimum dignity floor growth over time, while it may not have a cost of living adjustment attached to it, that's not necessary if the pension is so large to begin with that the minimum dignity floor you don't believe could possibly catch up to it, that with, of course, in combination with your Social Security, then I have no problem claiming it earlier. And it certainly increases the argument for claiming earlier when you're unlocking that extra $1,400 a month spousal benefit for your wife. So in a case like this, I do, you know, the question was, are we a reasonable exception? I think it is a reasonable exception from what you have described. If you are in fact confident that that pension or whatever other secure income is embellishing your Social Security to put you in the almost unicorn category is reliable enough and will keep pace with your future expenses, then I see no problem. Now, claiming early, just know that yes, you can claim 6 months early, but only back to your full retirement age. So you said you reach your full retirement age in December. We're recording this in April, so you can only go back March, February, January, you know, December. So you can only go back 4 months if you were to claim right now. Your wife, who turned full retirement age in March, could also claim retroactively, but again, only back to full retirement age. So you're going to have kind of that bumping up against your goal to maybe collect 6 months back as a lump sum. But technically you have the ability to claim retroactively even a spousal benefit, as long as you don't run up against that rule that you can't do that earlier than your full retirement age. And even if you could, it would reduce, you know, the spousal benefit from what you otherwise would be promised if you could ratchet it back prior to that. So, I think, you know, what you're proposing is totally reasonable. There could be some side effects, you know, filling up some of the income tax brackets with Social Security that otherwise wouldn't have been there might curtail some opportunistic Roth conversions that might happen. But it sounds to me like that's not really your a huge issue. Sounds to me like you have more money than you're likely to spend. You're going to be leaving a lot behind. I like Jim mentioned taking the money and investing it. You could also take the money and leverage it into additional inheritance for someone, with maybe life insurance or something like that. There could be lots of things you could do with that extra $5,400 a month, that's coming in, even though, yes, you might be filling up some tax brackets with some money, but, you know, as long as you're looking at those and you're not consciously doing anything that has a super negative, side effect, I wouldn't be too concerned about that. So I think your train of thought is totally reasonable from what you've shared.
Nice. I like that answer. Very good. Thank you. And we did receive a text from Greg, from Jacob, and he can come on the show, so we'll bring him in shortly. I just want to go through, folks, a few little PSAs that I forgot. This one, Chris, I think you're going to like. I was looking through the questions, trying to count out how many people were requesting the links for the payday loan issue that I shared. And I noticed a PSA question that came in the other day on our question that we answered for a gentleman, if you remember. So let me go through this PSA, because he does point out something that I don't believe we took into consideration. So this will all make sense when I go through this.
Okay.
Says, "Hi, Jim and Chris. As always, love the show and appreciate your perspective. On the show today," and this came in last Wednesday, "on the show today, you were discussing," you'll remember this in a second, Chris, "if it would be better to roll large IRA assets to a Roth IRA and if it should come from the younger spouse or the older spouse or pro rata between the two accounts. I want to offer a slightly more nuanced interpretation that I feel you and Chris failed to mention and could lead to significant tax savings. While I agree that taking from the older spouse's IRA makes sense in most situations, a lot will depend on the state the person lives in, and there may be a better solution. For instance, in Colorado, the first $20,000 of IRA, pension, or Social Security income for those between 55 and 64, and the first $24,000 of that same income, which again, folks, is IRA distributions, pension payments, or Social Security, the first $24,000 of income for those over 65 is not taxable at all at the state level. Of course, all Social Security is also not taxable now, but it is the bottom of the cake stack of that subtraction." I don't know what he means by that as far as Colorado goes, Chris. Colorado didn't totally absolve Social Security from taxes, did they?
They did. But what it does is it eats through your $24,000 first, so you don't get free Social Security and another $24,000.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that's what he means by the cake stack at the bottom. But yes, if you're talking just Social Security income, once you are 65, it's, is it 65 or 60? What did he say? He seems to know what he was talking about. Now I'm second guessing myself. I think it's 65. But as young as 55, then you have that $20,000 offset for retirement income, which could be Social Security or other forms of what they deem retirement income. But yeah.
Okay. So here's what he said then. He said, "Therefore, in the answer to your question to those listeners, one was age 60 and the other 63. I think what you said, their ages, I think, from what you said, and yes, listener, they were 60 and 63. Therefore, they should actually convert $20,000 from each spouse, and then the rest can come from the older spouse like you recommended for the minor extra help in reducing their future RMDs."
That's a good PSA.
This, yes. This strategy leads to an immediate and permanent tax savings of $880 a year at the Colorado state level. And this, again, listeners, applies to any state. And he wanted to make that clear that doesn't tax Social Security distributions. And I agree, Chris and I never factored that into our answer. It will then increase to $1,056 a year in tax savings once they are over 65. So spreading the conversions out to both spouses instead of just taking it from one could lead to $14,000 in state tax savings. Now, this listener did not live in Colorado, I don't think, or did they, Chris? I can't remember. Maybe that's why he's using Colorado as an example. I can't remember. Wait a minute. I think they were in Colorado, weren't they?
I don't recall.
Gosh, I can't
this
remember.
This person is pretty knowledgeable about Colorado, so might be from here themselves, but
well, he goes on. I'll read his last sentence. Hold on. He says, so spreading out the rollover or conversions to both spouses instead of just one taking it could lead to $14,000 in tax savings before they even turn 70. If you add the compounding effects of that tax savings, assuming it was invested, it could mean $56,000 to $112,000 more spending power at age 90. Now, he didn't give any idea of what he's investing it in and if it was tax deferred or what. But he makes a good point. This tax savings could theoretically be invested and at age 90 give them even more money to spend. I don't know the taxability of Roth conversions in every state, but I'm sure others may be similar to Colorado. Cheers. He gives his real name. We're going to call him George. This particular George, I want to thank because I admit I did not factor that into my answer and neither did you. And I like it. And he's 100% correct. If your state is one of the handfuls of states that treat distributions from IRAs differently and either exempt them from taxes totally or have a limit on the exemption like Colorado does, it would make sense to convert from both IRAs. And then when the state tax savings is used up, so to speak, then yes, it might make more sense to start converting the older spouse's IRA so you can get as much converted, maybe even all of it, if that was your goal, before they reach required beginning date for their RMDs. Mm-hmm. But I like his PSA, don't you?
For sure, yeah. A lot of states, it's either taxable or not, so there isn't this kind of graduated thing. But when you have a limit, he's very correct about Colorado there being an opportunity when you have spouses of certain ages where you wouldn't want to just default to the older spouse because you'd be leaving that exemption on the table from the younger spouse by not utilizing their free, you know, $20,000, as he mentioned. But so state tax effects are something obviously unique to each of you out there in the states that you're in. The states with no income tax, this isn't an issue. You can focus just on the federal. But there's a lot of kind of intricate rules regarding retirement income and Social Security income treatment at the state level when you look across the country. We see that as we work with clients in lots of different states. Well, when we dig into the state-specific rules, I'm actually very surprised to see some things sometimes. They're very, very unique little carve-outs and treatment of things that are you definitely want to consider if your state has that applies to your particular activity that you're attempting.
Alrighty. Well, folks, we're going to do something that we never do. We're going to pause right now. When you come back, you won't even know we paused, probably. And we're going to get Jacob all signed up, and we're going to go from there. Okay, folks, you probably haven't even noticed that we paused, and we're back. This time, for the first time ever, a young planner who I admire greatly, who I feel is going to be a phenomenal planner as he ages, who's been working with us, goodness, I think for 5 years now, and was a student of Chris's, and you've heard me talk about him repeatedly. His name is Jacob. If you are a client of ours and you listen to the podcast, many of you probably have had the pleasure of working with Jacob to one degree or another. So, without further ado, I want to introduce everybody to Jacob. Jacob, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's hard to believe that this is my first time being on the show, and like you were saying, about 5 years. So it's good to be here. I'm not sure this is the perfect topic that I would have wanted myself to kind of pick to come on board as an introduction, but I'm looking forward to sharing kind of my story and how it relates to what you guys have kind of been talking about.
Perfect. I need to set things up and walk people through a bunch of stuff. So it's normally Chris who goes on and on and on the podcast, Jacob, as you know.
Right.
This will be me right now going on and on and on before you come in. But I do want you to share what happened to you not too long ago with a fraudulent activity on your phone through a text, which now the people who try to open up payday loans in my name have incessantly been doing for the past week nonstop. I get at least 3 to 5 texts a day, but I'll share all of that. So let's go back and set what happened and what Chris and I want to kind of educate you guys on, you guys being the listeners. Last week, I received a alert from Norton. I do have a service called LifeLock. From Norton. Well, LifeLock used to be a standalone company and then Norton bought them. So now it's either called Norton LifeLock or LifeLock Norton. I don't know. But I had always subscribed to LifeLock, then Norton bought them. And I got an alert from them last week, I think it was on Wednesday, that someone had tried to open up a payday loan in my name twice. And each time Norton had successfully blocked the payday loan. That was the alert I got. So I logged into Norton to find out what's going on, only to start to research on Norton's website more and more information. And I realized what I had done several years ago when Norton intercepted a much bigger loan of 200 and something thousand dollars. I can't remember what it was. It may even been 300 something thousand at this point. I can't remember. It's 200 or 300,000 something that somebody was trying to open at Chase Bank, but couldn't get through that series of questions they ask for you to be able to prove you're you. I'm sure you've all done that. I don't know what that's called, but they're kind of pulling information from your credit report and asking you a series of questions. The people couldn't get through that. But they had everything else. Norton intercepted that, set up a call with Chase, right with their fraud department, did it all for me. When I got on the phone, the fraud department knew everything that was going on. I didn't have to explain it. Norton had already done that, and my Norton rep was on the phone with me. Chase did confirm with me that the thief had my social security number, my name, obviously. Had everything but didn't know everything about me, and they couldn't get through those questions. So, anyways, it was killed, it was squashed, everything was saved. I felt fine. So, I started putzing around Norton's website because I never really paid much attention to it. And I noticed a little toggle switch to toggle on payday loan blocking. And I thought to myself 2 years ago, who wouldn't want that? So, I just toggled it on, not just, it sounded like something I would want. So I toggled it on and promptly forgot about it until now. Now, as I am chatting about this, I see how important what I did was. Because when I got those alerts from Norton, I did not get the handholding that I got when I applied, excuse me, didn't apply, but when someone was applying for that Chase loan, that much bigger, several hundred thousand dollar loan. And I was wondering why, but now it's coming to my attention that the major credit reporting bureaus are not the bureaus that payday loan providers and other short-term loans go to for approval. They go to other services. I didn't realize that at the time. And this blocking service that Norton has, I don't know how they did it. They blocked it But it explained to me on the Norton website that, hey, you've got to now go to these, I think there's five. I'm going to, Joe, the admin in the office, she is posting in the show notes today the exact links I got from Norton. I have not gone and froze my credit at these places. I'm going to read to you exactly in a second what Norton said, but I have not done what they told me to do. And what they're telling me to do is I've got to get my reports from these four or five agencies. And they told me where on the report to look. And if it shows that someone tried to or has successfully taken a loan, to immediately get a hold of Norton at an 800 number. And then I will be assigned someone to help me clear this up. So I want to share with everybody a little bit of what Norton is saying to me and a little bit about what it's saying I need to do. But before I do that, I want to share with you, and I received about six emails. I'm certainly not going to read them all, but I wanted to share with you an email. The first email came in on Saturday, and all what it said is, "Hi Jim, I enjoyed your diatribe today about the payday loan issue. As a result, I just added the protection by LifeLock under the umbrella of Norton 360, and I want to thank you." He then went on to say something about Medicare and stuff. I'm not going to get into that. 2 days later, I get an email from this man. "Jim, it seems as soon as I subscribe to Norton LifeLock Ultimate, I too have now received the dreaded payday loan alert. But I did have the lock button activated and it prevented any theft. Thank you again for alerting me and your listeners to this issue. I just thought, Jacob and Chris, imagine the timing on that. A couple of days after doing it, someone tries to take out a payday loan in his name, and whatever Norton does with that payday block thing seems to have worked. I don't think this gentleman is making this up at all. I have to believe him that, wow, I just was amazed by that. They say what, Chris, timing is everything?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, anything you want to add to that, Junior?
No, I don't think so. That's I think the timing there is pretty wild. That's I mean you, yeah, caught it just in the nick of time, it sounds like.
Makes me worry about it's happening in the background all the time and they're just being thwarted through natural verification means, but the attempts are being made constantly and turning that alert on alerted you to something that had been going on. That just seems like weird timing for it to happen that quickly. So it makes me even more concerned with what you're describing about these payday loans than what I understood from your story before.
And I wish Norton's website would share what this blocking is doing. That's what I want more info. What are you guys doing? How are you blocking this? Thank you for blocking it, but how the hell are you doing it? So I got some. I'm just going to read what I've learned. This is directly from Norton, and if you guys join, you'll be able to find this same info. But I think people are going to find what Norton is sharing about payday loans quite interesting. The reason I have Jacob on, ever since this has happened, I have received again anywhere from three to five texts a day. I always click delete, block, delete, and report as spam on my iPhone on the text. So they always come in from different numbers. And it's always the same. They're trying to entice me. They need a little more information for my loan. Now they've kind of ratcheted it up. My loan has been approved. Lucky me. Click here for more information. They're trying to get me to click a link in the text, and I won't. That's why I have Jacob on. He did click a link, not for this payday loan scam, for a different one, which he will share. But I want him to let you guys know the pain in the hiney that he had to go through. What I want you guys to know and why this is so, to me, important, I also received several voice calls. from a woman. The phone number, Chris, which again came in to me right off the bat, scam. Estes Park, Colorado. Seriously, somebody running a payday loan operation is going to give me a loan from Estes? I've never even been to Estes all year. But the number came in Estes Park, and I blocked it. And then I got another call, also from Estes Park, but a different phone number. Same woman, no foreign accent whatsoever. Very friendly, knew my name as James, knew my phone number. Just needed some more information on the loan that I have applied for, that she's ready to approve it, and I need to call them right away. See that, how they're trying to scare me, Chris, into contacting them?
Mm-hmm. That's one of the keys that they say about these scams, is there's always a sense of urgency that they try to create a story that they want you to react to quickly before you have a chance to think about it.
What I want you guys to do is put yourselves in the shoes of your parents. My mom is 85. She doesn't listen to the podcast anymore, so I could say this. If she did, I wouldn't be able to say it. She's 85. She has still got all her marbles. And mom, if by any chance you are listening, I love you dearly. You know that. And you do. You have everything upstairs. I'm amazed. But I do fear at some point something will go wrong. I have been at my mom's for the past 7 weeks. Now I've been home for two. Whole other story. I've got to fly out on an emergency this weekend, most likely. I will be in Florida next week. Jacob, I'll bring you up to speed on this. And I don't want to get down into that, but mom is fine. But I do have to go back to Florida. That said, I finally got her to allow me on her phone when I was there to turn off receiving phone calls from somebody not on your contact list. Mm. I kid you not, folks, when I would be at my mom's, her phone rang 6 or 7 times a day. And she would look at her phone and go, and put it down. And I said, what's the matter? She says, it's a scam. I says, well, how do you know it's a scam? She said, because it's not anybody's name I recognize. I'm happy that she can pick up on that, but I was fearful someday she wouldn't, or fearful someday, what do they call it, Chris, spoofing, when they make it seem like a number coming from someone else? Is that spoofing?
Yeah, the problem is that block you put on there doesn't stop that.
No, but what it does do, and she finally let me do it, is it sends all of them to voicemail. So I said, now you can listen to the voicemail and ascertain for yourself if you feel it's real. You can also get a hold of me or Gene to listen to the voicemail if you're wondering if it's real or not. So I feel a little bit better on that. What I don't like is you cannot block texts the same way. You cannot block text, at least on the Apple phone. I don't know, Google. And this is a week. Apple says, no, you can't do it. Text will still go in, even if they're from somebody not on your contact list. I suppose that's good and bad. Sometimes I'm out socially and I meet someone. I want to hang out with them. We just exchange phone numbers, do a quick text to each other, and boom, add them to the list and they're in. It's the easiest way. And I think they want to allow that to continue. And that's why I receive 3, 4, 5 texts a day for the last week. And I'm probably going to receive these damn things forever. I fear texts coming in and an elderly finger accidentally hitting that link in the text, trying to hit that little button that says delete and report as junk, is pretty damn close some of the times to the actual link that they want you to click in the text. And I fear my mom doing something similar to what Jacob did. And then all hell breaks loose. And I fear this for myself as I age. And it's horrendous how easy it is to steal from people and how much is stolen from elderly people. Again, it's part of the reason I don't feel my firm yet is truly at the level of what a proper retirement planning firm should be. But it will be someday. And it will take care of me in retirement. And if told Jacob many a times, if he doesn't leave, and if he doesn't, I'm going to kill him. So he's either going to be dead or working for us. He's going to be my personal advisor, because I need someone making sure I'm not going to be stolen from. So back to this payday loan thing. This is what I want to read, because I had to dig deep into Norton's website. They don't make it easy to find, but they write this. Short-term loans include payday cash advances, secured and unsecured loans. But these loans may not generate credit inquiries. A lot will depend on the company's requirements. When someone is using your personal information, such as your name, date of birth, or social security number, to apply for these loans, a notification may be generated. But these loans do not generate a credit inquiry, so you may not be aware one even exists until it shows up delinquent. These loans are based on someone giving collateral to the issuing company, such as writing a check for deposit at a later date. Consumer reporting agencies offer consumer reports to these lending companies for their payday loan decision-making process. These companies can also serve American consumers, because they will provide information on you, including your payment history, records of any prior payday loans, deposit accounts, and any short-term loans you will have. But these consumer reporting agencies are not lending companies. They are not the same as the three major credit bureaus, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian. Some of the larger consumer reporting agencies include, and all these links will be in the show notes, DataX, Teletrack, FactorTrust, and MicroBuilt PRBC. Let me ask Jacob and Chris, have you guys heard of any of these companies? Because I never did.
Not a one for me.
I certainly haven't either.
I never knew, folks. Upon your request, these companies will send you your annual consumer report. This isn't a credit report. I didn't even know you had to request a consumer report. Where the hell is the financial press on all this? We'll send you your annual consumer report and set up security freezes for you. These consumer reporting agencies may also have data on you regarding payday loan applications made in your name, whether any of the three major credit bureaus knew or not. Because payday loans do not always generate a credit inquiry with the three major credit reporting bureaus, so you may not even be aware one was made until it shows up delinquent on your actual credit report with those agencies. You can ask for your consumer report immediately after you have been notified that an inquiry was made. This will give the agency adequate time to gather information on whether or not the loan was approved. Unfortunately, Norton LifeLock can then help you to take action to resolve the fraudulent activity. This was a screenshot. Below the screenshot is where Norton said, unfortunately, they cannot do it for us. We have to do it ourselves. And it said, you have to get the consumer report directly from these agencies. And I want to go over something. They gave instructions for one. Look at these instructions to get my consumer report. Because what Norton is saying is they want me to get a hold of all four of these get the consumer report so I can look to see if a loan was applied for or if a loan was taken out. If either of those two show positive, immediately call Norton. And then it said, here's some instructions for how to get it from Data X. Listen to this. This is what frustrates me even more with these quote unquote consumer agencies. And I have to do this four or five times. You will be asked. So what it says, okay. You will be able to request your consumer report immediately once you have been notified that an inquiry was made. Now, don't forget, I've already received that notification from Norton. An inquiry has been made and they blocked it. So I guess that gives me the right now to get a hold of these agencies. This is the instructions for Data X. Follow these instructions below to have Data X send you your consumer report. One. Go to, and they list the website. We have it now in the show notes. Click the link to download your request form to request your Data X consumer report. Complete the form that is necessary and submit it via mail, M-A-I-L.
You're
not
kidding.
Email, M-A-I-L, to Data X. Allow up to 2 weeks for your report to arrive. Once you obtain the report, review the information carefully. There will be a section in that report for inquiries and another section for loans approved and issued. If you see one approved and issued, there should be a loan amount and the balance due. If you do not recognize any of the information in that consumer report, it is likely the report contains a fraudulent loan. Call your Norton Member Service Department immediately at 1-800-LIFELOCK, and we will provide further assistance. Data X will not assist you with this matter. Do not reach out to them if you see a fraudulent loan on your report. Are you guys as pissed as me on all this?
That's crazy. Yeah, now you can reach out to the lender to report it. Like if you don't have LifeLock and you want to pull that report, it's the lender really that you should be talking to advise them that this loan that they have attached to you isn't yours.
So this, folks, is everything that I'm learning. I haven't done anything for a week because I was kind of feeling good that Norton blocked two. But what if one got through? So now yours truly is going to be getting a hold of all four or five. I forget I sent the links to Joe. And it looks like you have to do it with snail mail and wait up to 2 weeks. Yet your credit report, you can get instantly downloaded. This is terrible if it truly is going to work this way. I'm hoping the information on Norton's website is old and Data X and the other three or four companies allow you to do this beyond printing something off of their freaking website, filling it in, signing it, and mailing it to them, and then waiting for one to arrive back in the mail. That's just asinine.
I just went to DataX. It says DataX is now an Equifax company. So they've been absorbed into Equifax. Mm-hmm. So you'd think.
Well, good. Maybe that will help.
Maybe. Yeah, that's just putting up hurdles intentionally to make it hard for consumers to deal with this. That is not an accident. That is an intentional act on their part, and they should be condemned for it, in my opinion.
If it truly is going to work the way Norton's instructions that I just read work, and I can't do it online, I agree, Chris. They are just taking their sweet little old time on this because I'm certain their money comes from getting all of these inquiry requests. And if they made it easy for us to turn ours off, it takes money out of their pocket. I told you before, and I'll say it again, you are the product. with any, whether it's these consumer reporting agencies now that I haven't even heard of, or the regular credit reporting agencies that we all know, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian.
Oh, everybody just wait a second to get even more irate. I just looked at the form for Data X right at the top. Important. It is still a form you print out and mail to them, to a P.O. box in Atlanta, Georgia. But listen at the top. For security reasons, do not send plain text personal information such as social security numbers, etc., via email. And then in red letters, please include a copy of your social security card and documentation confirming your current address, i.e. state ID, driver's license, utility bill, bank statement. Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to mail all that crap that we're supposed to keep protected?
Yeah, yeah.
But don't email it, Jim.
To a P.O. box?
Yeah, to a P.O. box in Atlanta, Georgia. Yeah, this is getting better and better as we dig into this. This is just
I'm not going to do that. I'm telling you right now, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
You think I'm going to mail all that crap out to a P.O. box?
Wow.
Wow is right. I hope everyone listening to this is getting as equally frustrated as I am. Thank God I had this... And again, this isn't a shout out for Norton. They ain't paying me diddly squat. I just happened to have them and click that little link to activate this payday loan thing. Then we get this email from a listener 2 days after activating his. He gets a notice that someone tried to take out a payday loan. I'm appalled at this, but equally appalled that we have to do. You don't have to do that to get your Experian credit report. I get it with a click of the button every year.
Well, I'll tell you, this is the exact kind of thing that the FTC via the Bureau of Consumer Protection is supposed to be looking into. So when we hear that that bureau is on the chopping block, who else, you know, that is what governmental entities are supposed to do, protect their citizens from crap like this. We talk about fundamental actions of the government. This is an ideal case to have examined by the Bureau of Consumer Protection at the FTC.
This has been going on for years. They should have squashed this long ago. I fault Congress. You can fault the bureaucracy, and I certainly don't want to turn this into political. I'm trying to keep the show apolitical, whether you support or don't support what the current administration is doing. But this is Congress. Congress created the rule to give us our free credit report. That wasn't a consumer agency. That was Congress granting that to us. They need to just say, hey, the American public is the product. You cannot make money off of the American product without them opting in. That's what I want them to do, but Congress is never going to do that. So I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. But this is frustrating because I am not, folks, if I have to do that on all these other ones as well, I am not going to mail to a P.O. box, copy my social security number, a copy of my driver's license, copy of a
bank
utility
statement,
bill,
they said. Yeah.
Bank
crazy.
Statement.
Crazy.
You're nuts. The very stuff that my firm can be fined over by the SEC by not protecting, you want me to throw in a mail to a P.O. box?
I just like that it says specifically not to email it because of the security reasons right above that.
Yeah.
As if mail was never lost or stolen. I'm not throwing all post people under the bus, but there's many cases of postal workers knowing which envelopes to steal because it gets sort of all good information. How hard would it be for a postal worker in Atlanta to say, wow, everything going to this is going to have social security number. It's going to have an ID. It's going to have addresses. It's going to, let's steal this envelope.
Yeah. It's nuts. Well, let's get to Jacob's story or we're going to have invited him on here for nothing because we're going to have to wrap up pretty quick.
So, Jacob, explain to everyone what you told me recently because you did inadvertently click a link in a text. Explain what happened to you and how you fell for it.
Well, I'll kind of preface, kind of my experience with this by saying that I feel, personally, like I kind of grew up in this era of, being careful about scammers. I grew up in like the cell phone age where, I feel like we've, it's, yeah, granted, there's been more and more of those kind of scam texts, right, that you've received over the last couple of years. But, my entire kind of adult life, I've been aware of these things and kind of cautiously looked out for them. And I say that to kind of preface my story, just to kind of reiterate to everybody that you could seriously be sitting there at home right now and thinking, well, I'm on top of this. I keep an eye out on this. I'm always skeptical. I always have my red flags that come up. I'm not going to fall for anything like this. And that's exactly how I honestly would have felt if you would have talked about this, to me before it actually happened. So what it ended up happening was, I was just sitting at home one night. Granted, it was later in the evening. I had two phone calls that came to my cell phone. The first one, anytime a number comes up on my cell phone, I'm skeptical as anyone. I look at it, I see if it's a contact or not. This was just a random phone number, but under the phone number in parentheses, it had my particular credit union that I have, some of my bank accounts at. So I thought, oh, okay, well, that's kind of weird. But it was after the workday. I was kind of thinking, oh, that's it's probably a scam. Even though it said, hey, this is your credit union theoretically calling you. My initial reaction was, oh, this is a scam. So I silenced it. They called back immediately a second time. I once again thought to myself, hey, this is kind of weird. Silenced it right then and there. They then called back a third time in a row immediately. And finally, now my brain is thinking, okay, well, they're calling three times immediately in a row after I cancel it on them. It must be something. So I pick up the phone, and the first thing I do is I look at the phone number that's calling me. And although it says my credit union on it, I'm still skeptical. So while I pick up the phone and it's somebody claiming to be from the fraud department, getting a hold of me, the first thing I do in the background before giving, this gentleman any information is I go to my credit union's website, scroll all the way to the bottom, and I look and I verify that the phone number I'm receiving a call from is the same phone number that's calling me. And it was one for one. It was the same. It was being displayed as the same phone number that my credit union would, you would normally reach out to. So that was my first kind of little step in, hey, red flag popping up. Okay, I'll do a little bit of kind of verification and check things out. That was the first thing I did. I overlooked it, obviously, because it was the same phone number. The gentleman keeps talking to me. He starts going into saying, hey, somebody has access to your bank account, fraudulently. I believe they said it was a gentleman in Texas at the time who they said had been using your account through kind of like an Apple Pay equivalent, but for, a Samsung phone, I believe it was. At the same time, when the gentleman is telling me this, he's saying, hey, there was a fraudulent charge for, let's just say it was $800 or whatever it was at Best Buy in El Paso, Texas. I'm obviously sitting there thinking, okay, well, that wasn't me. In the background, I'm logging into my credit union on my phone, and I'm looking at the balance in my actual bank account to see if I'm seeing any pending transactions on my side. At the time, while this gentleman is on the phone, I'm not seeing any active pending transactions, anything mentioning Best Buy like this person's talking about. That should have been another kind of, red flag ticker that, thinking back on this would have been a glaring kind of thing, right, to point out that this was maybe fraud that I was being exposed to. At the time, I just thought, hey, maybe, the pending transaction isn't showing up quite yet, but these guys are on top of it. They're kind of looking out for me, and letting me know about it. So I think over the phone, once they told me that, they asked me a couple of questions, regarding some of the personal information. I never ended up giving them any, social security or anything like that, because I was obviously very skeptical. I think I did end up giving them, this was a checking account, I believe, that they were kind of looking into here for these transactions. I did end up giving them a checking account, and they had said that the fraudulent transactions were coming from my debit card, which was another kind of weird thing because although, yes, I do have a debit card with this credit union, I never use it. I'm always, normally using the credit cards. I haven't touched my debit card in a long time. So there was no way. I was kind of trying to think back, when was the last time I even used this card for somebody to maybe try and steal this information? And there really wasn't an event like that jumping out and saying, hey, oh, you used this debit card to get gas that one day. Maybe they stole it there relatively recently. So that would have been another you know, red flag jumping up that, hey, I never used this card. So realistically, how would it kind of get stolen? Again, you know, I went ahead and I kind of overlooked that, gave this gentleman some information on the bank account. They said that they were going to go in and look at the balances, look at the transactions, things like that. They put me on hold for an extended amount of time, put me through this whole kind of rigmarole. At any point in time, you know, I'm sitting there now in today's shoes thinking, right, you know, oh, how stupid was I to just kind of let this happen? But I promise you, like Jim was kind of saying, and Chris mentioned as well, right? In these cases, regardless of it's what I went through or somebody else, they're constantly trying to generate that urgency, and they're constantly trying to kind of keep you on your toes and lured into this to think, hey, you have to make some rash decision right now. Otherwise, you're going to, you know, lose this money, or things could get worse, things like that. So I just sat there patiently while they had me on hold, thinking that they were kind of checking things out. They put me through this whole rigmarole. Eventually, right? And this is, you know, this is maybe half hour, maybe even an hour, right, of being on hold. And obviously that should be another red flag, because, you know, your bank would never keep you on hold that long while they're looking into things like this. They were just trying to keep me on the line while they were going through my account and trying to, you know, take as much as they kind of had. Eventually, what ended up happening was they got to the point where they said, hey, we're going to, I believe it was email first to kind of start, Jim. They actually said, we're going to email you a link. They verified my email that was on file. They sent me an email. This was another thing that I did where I double checked, you know, I looked at the actual email address, right, that this email came from, to kind of verify in my head, hey, is this a weird, you know, URL that they're using? Is it a weird email address where sometimes, you know, as everybody's kind of experienced, right, you'll get those fraudulent emails where the email address is, you know, at, you know, XYZ, you know, 335. It's extremely long email handle, and you can kind of immediately mentally account for, hey, okay, this was fraud. This was not the case in the email that I received. Their email was realistic to what my credit union, you know, fraud department email, I expected what it would have looked like. I think there was a link in that email that they were coaching me through clicking to, you know, get even deeper into my account. I went ahead and I clicked that link. They put me back on hold for some amount of time. And then they told me at some point, and, you know, a lot of this I've kind of blocked out because I felt so dumb after the process. But at some point in the middle of all this, they kind of said, hey, we're going to, you know, freeze your card. We're going to, you know, shut down the actual account, and go through this whole information. They put some kind of, they acted like they were going to do some kind of test transactions on my account that I did end up getting, actual text notifications from. And what they were doing while all this was going on was they were actually just using the information that I gave them. There were no transactions in Texas, right? They were just using that for me to supply them with the information they needed to actually go out and do the fraudulent transactions. So as all this is going on, I'm getting texts from whether it's their kind of fake fraud department or my real fraud department now saying, hey, in Colorado Springs, Colorado, you know, there's a $1,500 charge to King Supers, which is a local grocery store in here in Colorado. And obviously I'm sitting there thinking, whoa, my gosh, this just got from bad to worse, kind of what's going on. I'm starting to freak out a little bit at this point in time. Eventually, you know, I get off the phone with them. I remember replying to one of the texts that they had sent me, where it was kind of like one of those texts where it was like, hey, you know, if you want security alerts ongoing for any fraudulent charges that might come up on this account, you know, send Y for yes to opt in. I remember them sending me one of those style of texts, but the response for it was not, it was weird. It was like send a V or something to opt into it. And I kind of was like, what is going on here? And I ended up actually not responding to that the correct way. And I vividly remember the person on the phone who was kind of trying to coach me through and had me fall for all this being upset at me for texting back to this kind of fraudulent opt-in message with the wrong response. And then at some point, I believe they just kind of hung up and let me go there. And then, you know, at that point, I'm really kind of freaking out and kind of acknowledging that that was definitely fraud. I'm feeling very, you know, stupid in the fact that I just kind of fell for this process. But you know, it is what it is. They, for their, you know, to their credit, right? Again, I would consider myself a very kind of skeptical person when it comes to a lot of, you know, these fraudulent things that kind of you receive on a day-to-day basis. but it just happened to be the right time, even though I had multiple red flags, right, coming up and multiple things that I was trying to verify, you know, I still kind of went through with the process for one reason or another. It just happened. The fallout of which here, you know, I'll kind of talk a little bit about, because, you know, Jim, you'll recall this happened right before you and I went to Orlando together for that Orion conference. And I flew down there and I kind of broke the news to you and said, hey, well, they got me. Now I'm going to have to spend, you know, hours as soon as I get back from this trip, setting up all my bank account and everything like that. So the first thing I did was, after I acknowledged it was, you know, real fraud, I got a hold of the legitimate fraud department, make sure that they froze, you know, all my cards linked to that bank account, make sure that they froze that bank account in general and kind of shut it down. I got back a hold of the bank, had to go through this whole process of obviously kind of trying to reset up a new bank account through my credit union. One of the things that they had kind of said was, and this is kind of attributable, Jim, to what you were saying when it comes to, you know, clicking links or texts or emails or something like that, the bank had kind of advised me in saying that, hey, you know, we'll walk you through kind of setting up a new bank account here. But one of the things we want to actually require that you do before we help you do that is do kind of a full reset of your phone to make sure that any of those links that I would have clicked, whether it was an email or a fraudulent text that I received, they were kind of under the opinion that, hey, there could have been some malware or some spyware that was actually downloaded locally on my iPhone that, you know, I wouldn't even know about. And they could just, you know, watch me input any future passwords. The last thing they want to do, obviously, right, is we go through this whole process of setting up a new bank account, and then the same fraudsters are just able to get the exact same information because they downloaded some software on my phone that was spying on me that I'm not aware of. So I went through the process of kind of hard resetting my phone. You know, that was a pain in itself because you have to get everything kind of reset up. Obviously, once I did that and went through the whole spiel with my bank to go ahead and get a new bank account number and get everything kind of transferred, they actually did end up helping me out in getting some of the fraudulent charges, well, all of the fraudulent charges back on my checking account, which was nice because I was a little fearful that wasn't going to happen because the funds were coming from like a debit card rather than a credit card. But I did end up actually getting the money back, which was nice. But once everything was kind of reset up, right, I had this new bank account. I had kind of verified that my phone was quote unquote clean. And then you have to go through, obviously, resetting up every single automatic payment structure that you've had set up for years upon years, right? Obviously your direct deposit, if you're getting, you know, a salary or income, all the insurance payments, right? Medical, vision, all that stuff that's getting, you know, automatically taken out every month, my rent that I get paid out, taken out every month. But you have to go through all of those different, you know, gas bill, utility bill, you know, car insurance, everything. You have to go back and kind of reset it up, add this new bank account, have everything kind of get structured, which was just a nightmare process and just stressful to kind of go through because you're already, you know, emotionally kind of feeling bad about the fact that you kind of fell for something like this, but you're also scared and wanting to go and make sure that you don't miss any of those kind of critical expenses that you're right trying to kind of reset up as you link this kind of new bank account. So that was, you know, a lot of time going through and kind of making sure that all of that was set up. And then, you know, I know Jim, you had actually talked to me about this a while ago, putting in the credit freezes on the three big kind of credit providers that we've been talking about, the personal kind of credit freezes. That was also something that, you know, the bank had kind of told me to go do and I had not got around to. But while I was kind of at this and going through and resetting everything up, I went to, you know, Experian and Equifax and that last one, TransUnion or whatever it was, and set up kind of a personal freeze on opening lines of credit as well. So,
and Jacob, you could do that all online, right? You didn't have to mail them copies of your license, your social security number, a utility bill, right?
Right, exactly. That was honestly one of the easier things in that process that I went through was just, you know, you obviously I had to kind of, you know, create an account in there, but it was super easy to go in there online, fully electronically, and just kind of freeze all those things in those systems. That was extremely easy for me to kind of set up. I didn't have to do any physical snail mail.
That was very compelling and interesting. And I'm hoping people can learn from that everybody listening, and thank you, Jacob, should, again, put credit freezes at the big three credit bureaus. Think long and hard about getting hold of these consumer things and mailing all of your personal identifiable information. That is just asinine. Totally up to you if you want to do that. Consider these monitoring services, and there's tons of them. I happen to be with LifeLock, as everybody knows. But if you choose a monitoring service, make sure they have something that blocks short-term and payday loans. Again, I don't know how mine were blocked, but what angers me, Jacob and Chris, I'm never going to know if an inquiry, how many inquiries were made, and if there's a loan out there, because I refuse to play along and mail all that stuff into a P.O. box.
Well, you'll know when they send you a collection notice, and then you can proceed from that point, because the people who take out those loans, of course, don't pay them back. And then you'll...
Oh, they don't? Well, that's not right.
I know. One thing I'll add about the credit freezes, just as a reminder, we've talked about this a while ago, but certain times when you go to do identity verification, which is what you were talking about earlier, Jim, for a variety of things, they pull information from your credit report in order to do the identity verification. And if you have your credit report frozen, it breaks that ability, and then you either fails the identity check and it stops you from doing what you were trying to do, or you have to use an alternative method. And Social Security, your online Social Security account is one of those. That ID verification process they go through at the federal government for access to those things online does that when you first set it up. So just a thing to keep in the back of your mind if you're going to go through one of those for anything, including setting up your Social Security online account for the first time, you need to unfreeze your credit report temporarily, go through the process, and then refreeze it again. So just a little heads
now, Chris,
up on that.
I'm not disputing what you said, but I did have to recently go through one of those just a couple of days ago. It was last Thursday or Friday.
And it worked?
Right around the same time that all this was happening. And what I wanted to share anyways with everybody is I made it through all the questions. I had the questions, and even though I have full credit freezes at the big three, mine still went through. Mm. But what was amazing, within seconds of docu-signing the document that I had to do, it was for an insurance company, docu-signing the document, within seconds, I get a text from Norton. Did I just complete an online verification via DocuSign? You know, yes or no? And I immediately clicked yes because it was mine. And it said, okay. I don't know how these credit monitoring services do what they do. But if someone was trying to take out a loan and had to go through this, it still worked, even though I have credit freezes, Chris.
Okay. So they must have changed that, or something's been updated, which is good because it was kind of a pain to do that. But that was another way to block these things, because if you could stymie the ID verification through the freeze, that was even more robust. But it was kind of an annoyance. So maybe so many people were running into that they decided to, the credit bureaus decided to change how the freeze works. It actually allows these questions to be asked based on the record. Last I heard, people had been blocked from setting up their Social Security account if they had their credit frozen. But it has been a while since I've heard from anybody, so maybe that has evolved and it's a little different now.
Yeah, mine worked in getting licensed at an insurance company. Mm, so okay. It worked for me. But I was just amazed that, again, I have no idea how these credit monitoring services work, how Norton knew that this was, I never would have known how it knew this was going on. And literally, immediately, as I am clicking and DocuSign is doing its thing, and then it says, you know, thank you for signing DocuSign, bing, my phone, I just pick up, it was right near me at the computer. I pick it up, it's the alert from Norton. I just thought that was pretty cool. All right, listeners, this probably went a little long, not a traditional Q&A show. I hope you learned a little something, and we're not trying to scare everyone, but for those of you who want to be a little bit proactive, for those of you who are asking these consumer credit reporting agencies, you might want to think long and hard. I will check out the other three or four, see if they like this DocX or whatever it was called. But I refuse to put into an envelope all the stuff that we are told to protect and mail it to a P.O. box. I will not do that.
Interesting stuff. Well, thanks, Jacob, for joining us for your introductory visit to the podcast. Hopefully, we'll have you on to talk about some more financial planning focused or investment focused
The next one will
topics.
be a happier topic, maybe,
Yeah,
and
exactly.
that we'll feel better about it.
yeah, but thanks for sharing your story. That's
Yeah.
good info for people. So, yeah, so if you want to send in your own questions for a future Q&A show, you do that by sending an email directly to Jim. Jim@jimhelps.com is the email. That's Jim, HELPS.com. And on the subject line of that email, put that it's a question for the podcast and then include a couple words about the topic area. And we do prefer email rather than snail mail. So that would be the best to
But if
submit
you
your
do snail
questions.
mail, make sure you send a copy of your social security number, your driver's license, your passport, a utility bill, maybe your beneficiary designation forms. That would be helpful. What else do we need, Chris?
Don't say that.
Durable
Somebody will
power
take
of
you some,
attorney.
yeah, powers of attorney, all kinds of things. So, yeah.
And this is a joke. Please, nobody do that. I do not want to open up an envelope with all that stuff in it. That's just nuts. Thank you for getting that, Chris, because I would have been on a tirade next week for sure if I would have found
Yeah,
that.
as soon as I saw
That's
that in red
nuts.
print at the top, I'm like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. Not only do you
And
have to
that's
mail
the
it in,
company that Equifax just bought, you said, or
it
they merged?
says it's now an Equifax company. So it's now part of them. Maybe that process will change going forward, but right now it still sends you to that document to print out and mail in. So good luck with that. So thanks a lot for everybody. Marathon show. We'll be back with you next week, with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier and Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.